our second case today, 11AP1673CRNM, State v. Foster. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Foster, Assistant State Public Defender John Richard, and is it Breffy? Breffy. Okay. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Thomas Balestrieri. You have 30 minutes, and counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal after your 25. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is John Breffel, and I represent Cassius Foster. The issue in this case is whether the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule should permit the state to introduce blood test results that were the product of an unconstitutional blood draw. Now, there's a second issue in this case, a sentencing issue, and I'm certainly prepared to answer questions on that issue. However, it's well argued in the briefs, and I'd like to focus today's argument on the Fourth Amendment.
What about an issue of did the Court of Appeals correctly accept the no merit? Wasn't that in this case?
That actually speaks to both issues in this case. Since the Court of Appeals accepted the no merit report, it simply stated that there was no issue of arguable merit. So the Fourth Amendment issue will kind of bleed into the sentencing issue. If there's arguable merit to either issue, then the Court of Appeals should have rejected the no merit report. The facts of this case are fairly simple. Mr. Foster was stopped for driving 50 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour speed zone. Once the officer approached the vehicle, he determined that Mr. Foster may have been intoxicated, asked Mr. Foster to exit the vehicle, and he conducted the standardized field sobriety tests. After the standardized field sobriety tests were done, the officer conveyed Mr. Foster to the hospital and ordered a nurse to conduct a non-consensual, warrantless blood draw. That blood was sent to the state crime lab, and as a result of that, the state crime lab determined that Mr. Foster's BAC was .112. Mr. Foster challenged the allegations of OWI at trial, and he was convicted in large part because the BAC was introduced to the jury. So why are we here? We're here because the blood draw itself was unconstitutional. And we know it was unconstitutional because under extremely similar facts, the United States Supreme Court said that using the totality of the circumstances test that was established in Schmerber, there were no exigent circumstances to support a warrantless non-consensual blood draw. Now, I think it's important to note that this case is not about police misconduct. We are not going to argue, and certainly the state won't argue, that the officers did anything but act in good faith reliance on a superseding decision by this court which suggested to the police that a warrantless non-consensual blood draw would be permissible under these circumstances. The way these cases shook out, Schmerber was decided in 1966. And again, as the United States Supreme Court said in McNeely, California v. Schmerber established a totality of the circumstances test for determining whether exigent circumstances would support a warrantless non-consensual blood draw in the case of an OWI investigation. This court decided Bowling after Schmerber. And in this court, the decision came out stating that the dissipation of alcohol itself creates a per se exigent circumstance, thereby allowing police officers to conduct warrantless non-consensual blood draws whenever they have arrested a defendant and believe that that defendant may be intoxicated. Now, we know that decision was wrong. And we know that decision was wrong not only because Schmerber says it's wrong, but because the United States Supreme Court in McNeely has said that it's wrong. So the real question here is not really whether there was an unconstitutional search. There was. The real question here is whether the results of that unconstitutional search should be admitted because an officer relied in good faith on this court's decision in Bowling. We don't think that the results should be admitted. And the reason is because this case is very similar to another case, State v. Hess, in which this court determined that judicial integrity requires evidence to be suppressed under similar circumstances.
Counselor, now I take issue with you on that point. I when I read your brief, I see this statement that the integrity of the courts demand that we not okay what was done here. And so I went back, and at first when I read it, I thought, well, if that's the case, how do you ever get to a good faith exception like you have in Leon and like we have under our jurisprudence as well? And so I went back and I tried to find where the integrity of the court comes up. And if you go back and look at it, from the first time I could find that it was used, it always applies to affirming wrongful police conduct. Now, you just said to us, this case is not about wrongful police conduct. So I don't think you can argue that the integrity of the court system or the courts have anything to do with this case when you're not also arguing that what's going on if the court affirms the conviction is affirming unconstitutional conduct. I don't see how you get there.
Well, it's...
You didn't cite any case, by the way, either, to support the proposition in your brief.
We think that this case is very similar to State v. Hess, where in that case an officer relied on a judicially authorized warrant. In State v. Hess, there was an arrest warrant that was issued by the court, and this court determined that the court ultimately didn't have authority to issue that arrest warrant. The officer took that warrant, went to a defendant's home, arrested a defendant, and when arresting that defendant, developed facts which led to other charges. Now, this court ended up suppressing those facts, not because the officer in that case did anything wrong. The officer did exactly what is expected of an officer. It relied on a judicially authorized warrant to arrest a defendant. However, this court determined that in that case, since there was no oath or affirmation attached to the request for a warrant and there was no statutory authorization for the courts to issue a warrant, the warrant was void ab initio. And therefore, the officer, while relying in good faith on the issuance of the warrant, his good faith could not save the unconstitutionally obtained evidence.
Okay, so you're wanting to extrapolate that into taking a blood draw and using the blood draw.
Well, yes, and the reason is because Schmerber was directly on point when it was decided, and it's in Schmerber discussed exactly what has to happen when a warrantless non-consensual blood draw occurs.
But integrity of the courts, I mean, if the court makes a mistake, you have the opportunity to appeal. I mean, you're here before us telling us the courts below made a mistake. So I don't get the connection. You might try me again, but I'm just not getting the connection with integrity of the courts when there's nothing here that's occurred, as you tell us in this case, of police officer misconduct. I'm just not getting the connection.
Well, there's a difference between an opportunity to appeal and the ability to actually get a remedy. And the good faith exception, if applied in this case, would seemingly accept that, yes, there was an unconstitutional blood draw that occurred, a constitutional violation, but it would deny my client a remedy.
Right.
The catch is, here, the United States Supreme Court had spoken in Schmerber and recognized a constitutional right that existed under the federal Constitution. This court took an extraordinary step of creating a rule that contradicted the rule set forth in Schmerber. Schmerber determined that the totality of the circumstances and only the totality of the circumstances could justify a non-consensual warrantless blood draw. We determined that the dissipation of alcohol in a person's blood would create a per se exception to the warrant requirement. And the United States Supreme Court took an even more extraordinary step of taking the exact same issue back and saying, no, what we said in Schmerber, we meant, and we're not willing to take the next step and extend that rule to create a categorical exception that was used by this court and asserted by the state in McNeely. And so what we end up having is a constitutional right that was established that my client had, and then a violation of that constitutional right by the police. And the sole reason why that violation occurred was because of this court's decision in Bowling, which conflicted with a United States Supreme Court decision that was decided earlier, which was Schmerber. And so our argument to get to Hess is that this court doesn't have the authority to contradict the United States Supreme Court on issues of federal constitutional law. And so its decision was void when it decided in Bowling that a per se categorical exception applies when previously the United States Supreme Court had said that you have to look at the totality of
circumstances. I still don't get how all of your argument goes to the integrity of the courts. I mean, that's where I started, because the argument that you have to preserve the integrity of the courts generally goes to either, well, to not affirming police misconduct, okay? And you're telling me there's no police misconduct here. And then your answer to my question to me relies on we got it wrong in Bowling, as the Supreme Court has explained in McNeely, and we should have known that if we'd read Schermerger correctly. I get that argument, but to me that's just a standard appellate argument. I think you make it well, but I still don't get how it applies or preserves the integrity of the court to buy the argument.
Well, I guess the point that we're making is, in this case, it's rather unique because the sole reason for the constitutional violation is because this court did not abide by the ruling that was set forth in Schmerber and went a different direction. And so to the extent that this court may have believed that there were two possible interpretations of Schmerber, and while we disagree with that, the United States Supreme Court disagrees with that in using its language in McNeely, to the extent that this court believed that that was the case, it then set forth two potential avenues for deciding Bowling, and it said in one of them they believed.
I understand that. I mean, I understand your appellate argument. I think you make it very well. I just don't see, without an allegation of police misconduct, that you are trying to keep the court from affirming, that the integrity of the court comes into the argument at all.
Well,
that's what you just appeal, and that's what you're doing, and that's fine.
Well, let's try this. You think McNeely is retroactive?
We believe that Schmerber is prospective. And
okay. Well, either way, as I understand your briefs and argument, your conclusion is that the law is, and at least in the foreseeable future will be, that you cannot have a warrantless search for blood, a blood draw, without some exception to the warrant, either consent or exigent circumstances or not. That was the law in 2000, it was a law in 19, whatever. So that Bowling was just, in your view, dead wrong. McNeely says so. That means that's always been the case, that it's dead wrong. That in Hess, the police relied on what the court said was a dead wrong warrant, if I remember Hess. Cop used good faith, had a warrant, executed it. Court said, invalid. In this case, they have a warrantless search on the basis of Bowling and other cases which look on their face just like the warrant was okay, and it's dead wrong, so you can't apply it. And if the court goes back and says, now you can bring in what has always been bad evidence, that is, violation of the Constitution of the blood by a warrantless blood draw, that affects the integrity of the proceeding, because the court is relying on evidence that you argue was always bad evidence, unconstitutional evidence. That's what I mean by bad evidence.
Is that your argument?
That's the thrust of our argument. That's correct.
Okay. Where do I get the thrust wrong?
That's a very good explanation of our argument. You don't get any of that.
That's precisely what our argument.
There you go.
Okay, I just want to clarify that is your argument. Now, unfortunately, I didn't bring Hess in, but I have a sense that in Hess, the distinction was, on the face of that warrant, a careful police officer would see it was defective. Is
that true in Hess? I mean, that's my recollection. It's been a while, you know, since I read it.
In Hess, this court made mention of the fact that a careful police officer could have looked at the warrant and known that it may have been defective.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The court was very careful, and I can grab the language if Your Honor would prefer, but the court was very careful to say that we're not deciding this case at all on whether or not the police officer should have or could have known that the warrant was defective. The sole reason for the decision in Hess was based on judicial integrity.
Yeah, and you're arguing that it's not a matter whether the police officer should have known bowling was bad, because even a careful police officer may or may not have been persuaded that bowling was fully applicable. Was there an arrest here?
There was an arrest. The police officer testified at trial.
That was bowling, and that differs from the Tolbert case. And is this a direct appeal?
This is a direct appeal, Your Honor.
Would you like my copy of Hess? Chief?
Pardon me?
Would you like my copy of Hess to look at?
Which one? Hess?
Hess.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
I'm satisfied. Thank you.
I think what's important to note is that police officers aren't lawyers, and we don't expect them to be lawyers. And so we don't believe that the police officer should have tried to figure out what the law was after this court specifically told them. Now, that doesn't mean there is, I guess maybe I misspoke in saying that there was no police misconduct. There is police misconduct in the sense that my client's constitutional rights were violated. But the officer, and we assume for the purposes of this argument that the officer was acting in reliance on bowling. So the real question is then, what do we do, since bowling was the source of the unconstitutional search in this case? And this court has long recognized and long stated, and even in Hess decided a case based upon judicial integrity. And in this case, where the United States Supreme Court had already spoken, this court contradicted that decision and then was told that it was wrong. We believe that judicial integrity means that the evidence has to be excluded.
Counsel, let me ask you this. You continue to zero in on this terrible decision by our court, Bowling. let me just ask you, are we the only court in the United States that interpreted Schmerber the way Bowling did?
No, there were a few other courts that
had... Yeah, that was my impression. So there must have been some issue as to how it was appropriate to interpret Schmerber. Is that legitimate to say that? Or did everybody rely on bowling across the country?
No, there were courts that predated bowling. There were decisions that had predated bowling as well, and they were cited in bowling itself. However, my research has developed, I think, 12 cases in which other courts have found per se exceptions. This certainly is not near universal acceptance of this court's position. In fact, it seems to be a minority.
But there was not universal rejection either, was there?
No, as evidenced by the 12 decisions to the contrary. But I think it's important to note that the language in Schmerber itself was quite clear, and then the United States Supreme Court in McNeely said very clearly that Schmerber established a totality of the circumstances test and that it was not going to depart from that test to create the per se categorical exclusion that the state in that case was advocating. And so
did it take them about 20 years to do that?
Correct, about 20 years. But this is an argument that the state had made in its brief, and I think it's very important to recognize, while the United States Supreme Court may have denied a petition for a writ of certiorari in bowling, just because a court, an appellate court, denies to take discretionary review does not in any way imply that the court has approved of the lower court ruling. There's a number of reasons why a court may refuse to do that.
The reason I've been asking you this line of questions ties into your claim in regard to judicial integrity. And the implication of what you've been saying is that this court violated the idea of judicial integrity because we interpreted Schmerber the way we did. Is that really what you're saying here?
Well, we're saying that here, where a constitutional right was violated because of this court's decision, and the United States Supreme Court has said that that decision was wrong and was wrong all along, then yes, judicial integrity requires suppression. But I think maybe another way of getting at what your it seems the concern is that we're probably talking about an allocation of risk. And to the extent that this court believed that it had two options when it was deciding Bowling, and again, we don't believe that it did, and the United States Supreme Court does not seem to believe that it did. But to the extent that another case would arise where that's the situation, and there is one option that is clearly within United States Supreme Court precedent, a more prudent option, and another option that may not be within United States Supreme Court precedent, then when this court recognizes that that option may result in unconstitutional searches and seizures, that it should choose the more prudent option. We're talking about the rights of individuals, and the state has repeatedly hammered the rights of the police, but the police don't really have constitutional rights here that we're talking about. We're talking about an individual's right to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure. And let's make no mistake about the kind of search and seizure that we're talking about. We're talking about a blood draw, a needle inserted into the skin, into an individual's vein to withdraw human tissue for evidence of intoxication. We're also talking about evidence that, while it does dissipate over time, dissipates at a constant rate and thereby could survive seemingly some period of time, at least 3 hours under the statutory presumption, which would allow an officer to get a warrant. So we're not talking about evidence that could be destroyed immediately if it were flushed down a toilet. We're talking about evidence that does take some time to dissipate. So here, in our view, the judicial integrity is the fact that even in deciding Bowling, this court recognized that it could be deciding the case in a way that will cause constitutional violations, but went forward with that and then ultimately was wrong. And so in our mind, this is a very unique case. It is one in which the United States Supreme Court had spoken. This court contradicted the United States Supreme Court, and then the United States Supreme Court took the extraordinary step of taking the exact same issue back to say, again, we meant what we said in Schmerber, and we're not going to go any further.
If we really had contradicted the U.S. Supreme Court, don't you think they would have granted cert right away?
Again, I can't.
They're not fond of having their opinions tap-danced upon if they really are so precise in what they're saying.
Well, I can't speak to why the United States Supreme Court accepts the cases it does and why it rejects other cases, except that it itself has said that lower courts should not interpret its rejection of petitions for denial of petitions for writs of certiorari as any kind of approval of the lower court decision. And so here it's seemingly a pretty clear case of a constitutional violation. And the question is then what happens? And in our opinion, the constitutional violation had occurred. It was unconstitutional because of Schmerber. This court's decision in Bowling precipitated the violation, and now we know that that's
wrong.
Counsel,
how do you ever use the good faith exception? How does that ever come into play? Because if a statute is later determined to be unconstitutional and law enforcement relied on it, and then we can't really affirm their reliance under the good faith doctrine because we would then be affirming unconstitutional conduct. So I don't see how you can fit the two together.
We're not arguing in this case that Dearborn is wrong, okay? And the reason why Dearborn and the ruling that supports Dearborn, the good faith rule, can apply in that case but not in this case is because there the United States Supreme Court had issued a ruling in Belton that was clear. This court followed it in Frye. And then the United States Supreme Court changed its interpretation of the Constitution in Gantt. And so this is not a situation where this court was writing on a clean slate or deciding an issue of first impression. Here, this court was acting after the United States Supreme Court had already issued a very clear ruling. And so our argument is that, unlike Dearborn, which was based on Frye being overruled by Gantt, Bowling being overruled by McNeely is kind of a red herring. Bowling was always wrong. Bowling was wrong because of Schmerber, and it was wrong when it was decided. And so that gets us to the Hess line of cases, where when a police officer acts on a judicial action that's void, then the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule can't save the unconstitutionally obtained evidence.
one of the interpretations of judicial integrity, and your opposing counsel in a former argument said there might be a variety of definitions of judicial integrity. You focus, I think, to the consternation of some justices on the Bowling decision and whether or not the court had judicial integrity in rendering that decision. You know, that's pretty... Those words are kind of bold words, I think. I see the judicial integrity issue this way, that we as a court draw lines all the time. We balance values. Our role as a court is to be the guardian of the Constitution and to countenance an unconstitutional search undermines a very basic role of our court. That's a value. Another value is the good faith exception. There are a variety of reasons that the good faith exception is employed and makes sense. So we as a court have to balance those values. One is, should the guardians of the Constitution countenance an unconstitutional search, or should we as a court of last resort say in this case the value of the good faith exception is elevated over our role as guardians of the Constitution? That's the way that I see it, but you don't argue it that way. So what's wrong with my view of your argument as I kind of interpret it?
There's certainly nothing wrong with it. I think that was argued in Dearborn and ultimately rejected by the majority of the court in that decision. I think one of the important distinguishing factors, again, though, is that in Dearborn, this court was bound by Belton to decide Fry the way it did. In this case, this court was not bound by Schmerber to decide Bowling the way it did. In fact, it was bound by Schmerber to decide Bowling differently than it did. And so while the source of the constitutional violation, the ultimate source of the constitutional violation in Dearborn was the incorrect decision of the United States Supreme Court in Belton, which was later changed by Gantt, here the source of the constitutional violation was this court's decision in Bowling, which was, as this court seemingly foresaw in Bowling, potentially violative of Schmerber, which the United States Supreme Court ultimately said it was. And so in the narrow facts of this case, we consider judicial integrity to be that this court's decision in Bowling, which was the cause of the unconstitutional search, should then not result in a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule.
Counsel, your red light's on, but I was looking at what is it you want. And we haven't ever gotten to the Oklahoma issues here. So your conclusion is what you really want is that there was a warrantless, non-consensual blood draw, and there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment as applied to Wisconsin. Right?
Right, and we'd like it.
Then what happens?
Well,
should have been suppression. What happens? Do they go back for a new trial?
Correct. We would like a ruling from this court suppressing the actual evidence that resulted from the unconstitutional blood draw, and at that point, then there would have to be a new trial.
Okay. Your next sentence says, however, if the court declines to suppress, it should reverse the Court of Appeals order affirming the conviction and reinstate deadlines to file a notice of appeal or motion for post-conviction relief. Would you explain that to me?
Of course, Your Honor. In this case, Mr. Foster never conceded anything. He took the case to trial. He filed a motion to suppress. And then after trial, he instructed post-conviction counsel to file a post-conviction motion. Post-conviction counsel did that, and we believe that there was a lingering issue. However, post-conviction counsel didn't really litigate it. Instead of fully litigating the issue, post-conviction counsel withdrew the motion for post-conviction relief. Now, there's kind of the awkward facts of this case suggest that the circuit court still ruled on the motion after it was withdrawn.
And the motion was?
It was a collateral attack against the prior OWI convictions. But then after that occurred, Mr. Foster insisted that post-conviction counsel file a no-merit report, which he did, and the Court of Appeals accepted the no-merit report, despite, in our opinion, a lingering issue revolving around the prior OWI convictions, and now, of course, the lingering issue with regards to the constitutionality of the blood draw. And so for those reasons, we think that the Court of Appeals opinion was wrong, accepting the order and decision accepting post-conviction counsel's no-merit report was wrong, and that it should be reversed.
When you come back on rebuttal, can't we decide that issue about counsel and ineffective assistance of counsel, or do we have to send it back to the Court of Appeals to decide? Okay?
Okay. I can address that on rebuttal.
Right. You may.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Balestrieri.
As to your question of whether, the one you just asked.
Okay.
As to whether you can address the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel when that's never been raised, that's my argument next month in Waukesha in the Alexander case, where the Court of Appeals did that, and I'm suggesting that was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stick to this case, though. You got enough problems here.
I'm just saying, that's next month. The issue of whether you can reach ineffective assistance is next month's issue. This month's issue is
the... You'd be deciding that issue in this case, depending on how we decide it, without hearing your arguments.
Yeah, well, I think you ought to listen, read my briefs in Alexander and listen to my arguments.
Next month's case.
It's next month.
Okay, good. All right.
It's one of the Waukesha cases.
Okay.
As far as this case is concerned, one of the fundamental arguments that Foster seems to make is that this case somehow differs from Dearborn and Davis in that the decision of this court in Bowling was void, because it turns out it was contrary to the Supreme Court's interpretation 20 years later, more than 20 years later, 20 years after Bowling, much, much longer after Schmerber came down, decided that they were going to interpret Schmerber differently than this court interpreted the court in Bowling. And the public defender says that makes the decision in Bowling void. Well, we totally disagree with that.
Is McNeely retroactive?
I'm sorry?
Is McNeely retroactive?
Oh, sure.
And what do I mean, and what do you mean by retroactive?
Well, it applies to this case, because this case is still on direct appeal.
Does it apply to Bowling?
Does McNeely apply to Bowling? Oh, yes. Yes,
it abrogates it. That's what
it abrogates Bowling. Yes, it does.
Okay.
And
so Bowling is void.
No, it's not.
Okay, why is it?
It's not void. It's erroneous. And that seems to be one of the points of contention between the state and the public defender,
okay,
as to whether a case that's abrogated is void. They cite no authority for that proposition, that a decision that's abrogated by the U.S. Supreme Court is somehow void. It's gone, as if it never existed. That's what void means, as opposed to merely erroneous, which makes a big difference. The only thing that the public defender relies on is this case of the Supreme Court called Edgar versus MIT E-Corporation, and that doesn't apply to judicial decisions. That applies to legislative decisions. And in the Edgar case, the court quoted an earlier case, Ray versus Atlantic Richfield Corporation, and if you look at the Ray case, it states the rule more fully than the rule is cited in the Edgar case. And what we're talking about, when you go back and read the Ray case, what they're talking about is the preemption doctrine. The preemption doctrine, which goes all the way back, if you remember your Judicial History 101 from law school, it goes all the way back to 1819, McCullough versus Maryland. That rule has been around for a long time. And it applies to legislation. It does not apply to judicial decisions. What the preemption doctrine says is that there are certain areas of law that are exclusively within the realm of Congress to legislate. They preempt the field. They prohibit states from legislating in that area. They take away the power of the states to pass legislation. The states have no jurisdiction. And if the state does pass a law in this area that has been preempted by the federal government, it's void. Why? Because the state has no jurisdiction to do that. Now, the particular quote that comes in the Edgar case is the second part of the discussion in the Ray case, and that is that there can be situations where preemption is not complete. It's not total. There can be a situation where Congress preempts a field, but for the most part, 90% of it, but allows the states to do some things in that field. And if the state exceeds its authority to do what it is permitted to do by Congress in that field, to the extent that it exceeds the authority that's been given to it by Congress, its action is void. That's what the Edgar case is all about. That's what the Ray case is all about. This is the standard 200-year-old preemption doctrine. Neither of us has found a single case in which that preemption doctrine, which applies to legislation, which applies to acts of the legislature based on acts of Congress, applies to judicial decisions. We have a rule that a judicial decision is not void unless the court lacks jurisdiction to make it. But the court had jurisdiction.
What's your cite for that?
I have to look at my brief here.
Right. Tell me what page you're at.
I'm sorry?
What page in your brief are you at?
Yeah, I have to. I don't recall it just off the top of my head. I have to look it up.
Chief Lewis Butler wrote a decision in a family law matter that said if there was no jurisdiction, it was void ab officio.
I don't have any problem with that. That isn't what he is saying.
Okay.
He is saying a judicial decision is not void unless the court lacks jurisdiction.
Yes. And on page 10, on page 10 of my brief, I cite State versus Campbell. In fact, I rely on State versus Campbell.
Okay, let's look at that.
Quite a bit. It's the bottom of page 10, last paragraph.
It goes on to 11, right?
Goes on to 11, yes.
All right.
Lack of competency is not jurisdictional, I point out. Court does have jurisdiction to err, so that a mere error by the court is not a jurisdictional defect. It does not make a decision void.
Campbell was a constitutional issue?
I'm sorry?
Campbell was a constitutional issue?
I don't actually recall what the issue, what the underlying issue was in Campbell. It's just that it's a question of, you know, judgment is not void unless you lack jurisdiction. If you have jurisdiction, it's not void. It's as simple as that, black and white. It's a per se rule.
it says in your third paragraph on page 11, a decision that is overruled, because bowling was not overruled.
Well, bowling has not been overruled yet. Okay.
But because of this court has to overrule it.
This court would have to overrule
it. Not the U.S. Supreme Court.
It was abrogated by the U.S. Supreme Court. In other words, the the underpinnings of Bowling were pulled out from under it.
Yep.
But the U.S. Supreme Court has no authority to overrule a decision of this court that is not before the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And they have their opportunity. They have the opportunity to take up Bowling. They have the opportunity to overrule it. They didn't do it. And in this case, the only in the McNeely case, the only state court decision they had before them was McNeely, the Missouri case.
And the whole point of your discussion on Campbell and Blum is to get to the 5th paragraph on 11, which is, therefore, Foster's reliance on Hess, where this court refused to apply the good faith exception when police relied on a warrant that was void, is misplaced. So the warrant was void, but you're saying the prior case was not void. That's your distinction with Hess.
I don't take issue with Hess in this case.
Right.
I'm just saying this is a whole different case because we're not dealing with something that
was void.
That was
void. I understand.
Okay.
But could I ask you, what is your explanation of what happened in McNeely?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by what.
What are the judicial dynamics? You have Schmerber in 1966. You have McNeely in 2013. The argument is being made here that cases like Bowling were absolutely wrong, but in terms of judicial integrity, I totally disagree with that.
I totally disagree that Bowling was so wrong that somehow the integrity of the court was compromised by making the decision in Bowling. What happened in McNeely was that the prosecutor in Missouri liked the Bowling case. He thought it was a really good case. He wanted a per se rule. He couldn't get a per se rule out of the Missouri Supreme Court. So he went to the U.S. Supreme Court. He said, hey, look, Schmerber is ambiguous. Look at all these cases from lower courts. We got some saying Schmerber okays a per se rule. We got some cases saying Schmerber doesn't okay a per se rule. We want you to clarify Schmerber, and we want you to come and we want you to say that cases like Bowling were right, that they interpreted Schmerber correctly, and we want you now to clearly enunciate that the dissipation of alcohol in the blood creates a per se rule. I mean, that's the way the case got up there. The Missouri prosecutor loved Bowling. He thought it was a great case.
Okay. Were there any justices who agreed with him?
One. There was only one. It was McNeely is a really badly split decision. There were four separate opinions in McNeely, none of which actually commands a majority. The lead opinion was joined in by only four justices, not five. There were eight out of the nine justices agreed that we shouldn't have a per se rule. So that was a clear majority in McNeely. We should not have a per se rule. But there was a lot of disagreement on what the rule should be. Now, the plurality opinion, the lead opinion of the court says, oh, Schmerber, that should be the rule. But there were three justices, led by the Chief Justice, Roberts, who would have applied a different rule, an intermediate rule that was somewhat of a per se rule, but not necessarily a per se rule. Justice Thomas thought that a per se rule was just fine. He would have thrown Bowling.
Was he acting with a lack of integrity?
I don't think we could say that Justice Thomas was lacking integrity. I don't think so.
Well, I'm getting from your explanation that maybe McNeely isn't as crystal clear as some people would say.
It's not as crystal clear as some people think.
It is
crystal clear for the proposition that you can't have a per se rule. That it is crystal clear on. Absolutely. No per se rule. But it is not clear at all on what rule should be substituted for the per se rule. You have a split on the court that is, in essence, a 4-4 split on what the rule should be to replace the per se rule. And then you have the Ninth Justice, Justice Kennedy, saying, I'm not going to go along with either one of your proposed rules in this case. So we still have an open question as to what the rule should be. We know what the rule is not. The rule is not a per se rule. That's pretty clear.
Is the rule totality of circumstances?
We don't know.
Is that the rule the state wants us to adopt?
Is that the rule
the state wants this court to adopt?
No, I'm not suggesting what the... There's another case that's coming up out of Colorado.
Coming up where?
In the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall the name of the case. I'm not sure at what stage it's at. But Colorado, the Attorney General or one of the prosecutors in Colorado wants to bring a case to the U.S. Supreme Court, wants to petition for certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court to resolve this question that was left open in McNeely. If not a per se rule, then what? Because you did have that pretty even split among the justices as to what rule there should be that would replace the per se rule. And I'm not sure how far along in the proceedings this has come. I'm not sure if Colorado has actually filed a cert petition yet, but they're at least thinking about it.
Counselor, what rule do you want us to adopt from this case?
Well, I don't want you to adopt any rule. I just want you to apply the good faith exception. I don't think you have to adopt anything that hasn't already been adopted. You just have to apply it in this case. Which leads us to another.
You don't want us to interpret McNeely at all.
No.
You don't argue it doesn't apply, but we're not to tell folks out there how it is to be applied. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that McNeely applies to the extent that it abrogates the per se rule in bowling. And what I'm asking you to do in this case is not to delve into McNeely and decide which rule does apply. I mean, we think we should let the U.S. Supreme Court decide that. The only thing I'm advocating in this case is that you apply the good faith exception and to say bowling was controlling law at the time the search in this case was done, at the time that Foster's blood was taken, and because bowling was good law, the police...
I get that argument. Yeah. I mean, that's old hat. What I'm concerned more about is your argument that we say McNeely applies. There is no per se rule. But then we shut our mouths after that about is it the totality of the circumstances at the court? What are the officers to look at now? So you can say, well, they just have to get a warrant all the time, every time. There's just no out to that, or... What do they consider? How do they follow their obligations under the law? So you're saying we shouldn't say anything at all?
You don't have to do that in this case. That's all you have to say. That's all I'm asking you to do in this case is apply the good faith exception to say.
I know that's all you're asking us to do, Counselor, but other folks may read the case for one or two things other than what you're asking. They just might. They might want to know what we think McNeely means in regard to their obligations to protect the Fourth Amendment.
And at this point, I don't think you can really do that. Because of the fact that there was this split among the justices in McNeely as to what the appropriate substitute rule was. They didn't come down with a majority.
They may not have, but we have police officers on the street every day. They can't hold their breath while the U.S. Supreme Court decides if they're going to
take another path. Well, I can tell you what we're advising them to do. And if you want to advise them to do the same thing, that's fine. What we are advising the police to do is to apply the totality of the circumstances rule as articulated by the plurality, and I emphasize plurality, in McNeely. And we're saying, unless you can come up with exigent circumstances, get a warrant. That's what we're telling them to do. Unless you clearly cannot get a warrant, unless it is absolutely clear that the evidentiary value of the blood is going to be so far gone by the time you can get a warrant, get a warrant. That's what we're telling them. And if the court wants to tell them that, I've got no problem with the court telling them that. But keeping in mind that this is still an open question under McNeely, that the court itself didn't really decide that. And it's still an open question, and it may have to be decided in this case that Colorado wants to bring.
Counsel, I'd like to segue to another issue, and that is the collateral attack issue that is implicated also in the no merit report. I'm going to get right to the jugular of my concern. It's this. The Court of Appeals applied a clearly erroneous standard, which I think is clearly erroneous. The Court of Appeals decision in reviewing the circuit court's determination that Foster's waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntarily made treated it as a historical fact and applied the clearly erroneous standard rather than a matter of constitutional fact with independent review. In my mind, whether or not a plea was knowing, voluntarily, intelligently entered is clearly a question of constitutional fact. In fact, in your brief, you have, as in the appendix, the decision of State of Wisconsin versus Marcus Northfleet. And that brief case quite clearly sets forth the standard of review that we should all use. And yet the Court of Appeals here did something different. They said Foster argues that waiver of counsel were not made knowing and intelligently. As we described above, the circuit court has already determined otherwise. Of course, the Court of Appeals took the circuit court to task, took the no merit application to task as having a little bit of a problem with its analysis and rejected part of it. But at any rate, on appeal, we affirm that finding a fact unless it is clearly erroneous. Foster's response does not give us any reason to believe the finding was clearly erroneous. And they're referring to whether or not the waiver of counsel was knowingly and intelligently made. What do we do if I'm correct in what I read? What is the remedy for an incorrect application of law in their acceptance of the no merit report?
Well, let me preface my answer to this question by saying that I don't agree with your review of what happened in this case.
Well, I don't care what happened.
I don't agree with your statement of how the circuit court decided this case.
Okay.
I
don't mean to focus on the circuit court. What I mean to do is say, looks to me, page 5 of the slip opinion, that they applied a clearly erroneous standard to a question of whether something was knowing, intelligently, and voluntarily waived. That is the wrong standard of law,
well,
I believe. I might be wrong.
Well, no, I mean, you're right.
Yeah,
you're
so
right.
What do we do with that error if they reviewed that issue with the wrong standard of review? If they did. You know, you can say I'm reading
well,
it wrong or
something.
Well, you can
do two things.
But what's the remedy?
You can do two things. You can,
mm-hmm.
And again, I'm prefacing this on the fact that I have a fundamental disagreement with your recitation of what happened in this case. But assuming that they did that, assuming that the Court of Appeals applied the wrong standard of review, you can do two things. You can either review that issue yourself under the correct standard of review and come up with what you think is the correct decision, or you can remand it to the Court of Appeals for reconsideration under the correct principle of law.
It seems to me this, and I just don't know the answer. I'm not focused. My focus is not on what happened in the circuit court. My focus is solely on the Court of Appeals in its summary disposition decision got the wrong standard of review. Got the wrong standard of review. And so what to do about that? In my mind, it's complicated because of the different roles between the Court of Appeals and our role vis-a-vis no merit. This was a no merit appeal. And under Anders and cases that have interpreted Anders, it is exclusively that first appeal court, not our court, that has the obligation under Anders. That's what several cases say. So since this arises in the Court of Appeals accepting a no-merit report, but they have applied the wrong standard of review, can we just go ahead and decide the issue, or should we remand it since it's in the context of a no-merit Anders procedure?
Well, assuming that there was error.
Assuming that they got the standard of review wrong, and everyone can read it and decide if it's wrong.
I think the better course would be to remand it and have them reconsider the no-merit appeal.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, would be the better course. Now, having said
that... Why is that a better course?
I'm sorry?
Why is that a better course?
Well, just because the Court of Appeals is supposed to consider whether there's any merit to the appeal.
Well, of course they are. But when a legal issue is brought before us and we can decide it, why do we cost more money for the state's attorney, for the public defender's attorney?
I'm not saying you can't decide
back?
It. I'm not saying you can't.
No, I know you're not saying, but you said the better course is to remand
it.
Yeah,
I think
because
of what Justice Bradley was talking about, that it's the primary responsibility of the Court of Appeals to consider no-merit reports and whether there's any merit to an argument. They consider the whole record. So I'm just saying I think it's better, not that it's the only way to do it. But getting back to this, I think you have to read the whole record to see what the Court of Appeals was saying. I think the Court of Appeals was applied the right standard. If they may have articulated it erroneously, but they applied the right standard, because what this case revolves on is, in fact, a finding of fact. And under the procedures. Yeah, it's a finding of fact. And it's not a question of whether the defendant, of whether the state proved that the defendant did not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waive his right to counsel. The defendant has an initial burden in these cases to make a prima facie showing that he did not knowingly waive counsel. We had a problem in this case because in Oklahoma, These drunk driving cases are conducted in a court that's not a court of record. So we don't have a transcript. We don't know what went on. We don't have a nice Mockner-type hearing here where, you know, everybody goes through all of our Klessig-type hearing, actually, where everybody goes through all of this. Do you understand this? Do you understand this? Do you understand that? But what happens is, once the defendant makes a prima facie showing, the state can then have an evidentiary hearing at which the defendant has to testify. That's what happened here. We had an evidentiary hearing. Foster testified. The circuit court found his testimony to be incredible and therefore found that all of the allegations that he made in his collateral attack on his prior convictions were incredible. Therefore, what the court was saying was that the defendant never met his initial burden of proof because everything that he said was false. And that's what the Court of Appeals was reviewing. The circuit court never decided anything about the ultimate question: did this guy knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waive counsel? It was, he didn't make a prima facie showing because his allegations were false.
So your position is we should
affirm.
Well, I understand that, but your position is that we should take that into consideration, even though it contravenes the express words of the Court of Appeals opinion. And
you have to see what actually happened here is what I'm saying.
Even though they are applying the clearly erroneous standard in a couple of places, they're not really applying it.
They're not applying it to the ultimate fact. They're applying it to the circuit court's conclusion.
I understand what you're saying, and it makes, for me, sense to a point. The point is the words of the Court of Appeals opinion. They just used you're saying they just are using the wrong words, but they really, at heart, meant well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look to what the circuit court did, what the Court of Appeals did was right, even though they may have used erroneous verbiage. But they got it right, is what I'm saying.
Was there any evidence here about trying to get a warrant?
There does not appear to have been any attempt to get a warrant here.
Why, when you add Kennedy's opinion in McNeely plus Sotomayor, you get 5 votes if you review what is the narrowest decision? Kennedy says the real test, as I read Kennedy, the real test is, was there time for a warrant? If there was time for a warrant, then it's hard to show exigent circumstances. If you couldn't get a warrant, then it's exigent circumstances. He focuses on one test. Sotomayor focuses on that as a major test, loss, dissipation, and looks at the totality of circumstances. And here, there was no attempt to get a warrant. So why isn't that right within McNeely?
Well, it is within the plurality.
4+1.
Well, it wasn't 4+1. Kennedy did not go along with Sotomayor.
Well.
Not on the question of the exigent circumstances.
Okay, well, we can read it differently. Your brief deals with the fact that McNeely doesn't apply because it was, in this case, there was a forfeiture. That's why McNeely doesn't apply. That's what you keep saying.
I did say that, yes.
That's your argument.
That's one of my arguments.
Right. That's why you don't get to retroactivity, because it doesn't apply because it was forfeited, and therefore you only deal with good faith other than the Oklahoma one.
That is one of my arguments, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Balancieri.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you. I just want to quickly begin by saying that we categorically disagree with the way the state reads McNeely. And I think that the Chief Justice really started to hit home on this at the end of the argument. The narrowest opinion of McNeely, which does include Justice Kennedy's
concurrence in part.
Concurrence does say that it's a totality of the circumstances look at the time that it takes to get the warrant. Yeah. But what's important is that he did join this language with the other justices that said, our decision in Schmerber applied this totality of the circumstances approach. In that case, the petitioner had suffered injuries in an automobile accident, was taken to the hospital. And so even five justices in that case, at least with Kennedy's concurrence, agreed with that language. And then in Justice Roberts' concurrence, which was joined by Breyer and Alito, he stated that I have no quarrel with the court's totality of the circumstances approach as a general matter. That is what our cases require. And so our point is this, that while there may have been some kind of split as to what going forward McNeely should mean, eight of the nine justices agreed that under Schmerber it was a totality of the circumstances test.
So you're saying their referral to Schmerber sets the standard that comes out of McNeely that we should then apply in our decision?
At least in this case, yes.
Thank you.
I think what's also important is that the state really harps on this language, void ab initio, that was used in Hess. And our position is very clear that this court cannot contradict the United States Supreme Court on issues of constitutional law. And so this court can call it what it wants. The language in Hess was void ab initio, but the principles really remain the same, that the United States Supreme Court had spoken in Schmerber and that this court chose a different test in Bowling, which it had no authority to do under the Supremacy Clause. And so the state is correct that these are really old principles of constitutional law. They all emanate from the Supremacy Clause, and they all emanate from the fact that federal law is supreme over state law. And so the language in the cases that we do cite cites to legislative determinations, but there is no real meaningful distinguishing factor between a legislative decision and a judicial decision, not at least in the context of this case and these types of cases. The only other two points I wanted to discuss were the Chief Justice's question about deciding ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't think that this court can really make that determination, and I don't think it can make that determination for a couple of reasons. One, the facts were not fully developed, and they weren't fully developed for a few reasons. One, post-conviction counsel withdrew the motion for post-conviction relief, didn't argue it, never entered an argument, never really cross-examined his own client after the state had conducted a direct examination. And so there aren't enough facts to make a finding of ineffective assistance of counsel, and additionally that would be at this point still require findings of fact, which really the circuit court ought to be the one to do. The second question that was kind of discussed was with regards to remanding this case because the Court of Appeals applied the wrong standard of review and may have looked at a constitutional fact as clearly erroneous. I think the problem is that it misses the larger point in that the Court of Appeals essentially made a finding of fact that the circuit court purported to make in this case but never really got the chance to do so with tested arguments. And that's because post-conviction counsel withdrew his motion and then didn't clarify any points with cross-examination with his client after the client was put on the stand by the state, didn't make any closing arguments or argue the law, simply withdrew the motion. It was only after he withdrew the motion that the circuit court made a finding of credibility, which was used by the Court of Appeals to accept the no merit report.
Counselor, I look at his affidavit that he submitted in regard to whether or not you can count these extra OMVWIs that occurred in Oklahoma, and you know, in paragraph A, he says, based on information and belief, I was not advised of my right to have an attorney represent me if I could not afford one, which I could not at that time. Is making an affidavit upon information and belief sufficient to support a factual assertion, or does State versus Negrete, our opinion, where someone couldn't remember if something happened as it was based on information and belief, does that get in the way of sending this back?
In other words, is the affidavit just insufficient on its face?
We don't believe so. And in the affidavit, he says that he didn't understand the penalties as well. And I think that's very clear. I understand the qualifying language that this Court's concerned about, but I would point to two things. One, pleadings should be liberally construed to a degree, especially when the thrust is very clear. In this case, it was. Secondly, Negrete is a plea withdrawal case, and here we're talking about challenging prior convictions for the purposes of sentencing, which comes under a different set of rules under Ernst. And so we believe that...
Do you think the allegations of fact are different under Ernst?
We think that in this case he met the allegations of fact. I think what we're saying is the affidavit itself was sufficient under Ernst.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both defense counsel and representative of the state for their arguments in Foster, again relating to the understanding of McNeely, the application of it, and your arguments relating to the how we treat the Oklahoma convictions. That concludes 11AP 1673 CRNM State versus Foster, and we'll have a third case relating again in some fashion to McNeely, but Mr. Balestrieri will not be arguing it for the state. The court's in recess for lunch, and we'll 1:30.